This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey guys, normally I don't start this with all this sort of newsgirl attitude and everything, but just hours ago we had some pretty serious breaking news from the time we're taping this, which is Monday, June 7th. The U.S. Department of Justice officials announced they have recovered millions of dollars worth of Bitcoin directly related to that ransomware attack from the Colonial Pipeline hack. Obviously, lately, cyber attacks have been very much at the center of attention, from, yes, the Colonial Pipeline one, to the recent hack of JBS, the meat processing giant, to smaller little attacks this weekend shutting down three news bureaus. So I thought, hey, you know what? We need to bring in somebody at the center of cybersecurity, a guy who not only has extensive knowledge of the cyber world, but also, which works perfectly for Everyone Talks to Liz, he has the most unbelievable story of determination that spans continents and startups, starting, failing, beginning again. Jay Chaudhry was born in the Himalayas without running water or electricity before immigrating to the United States for university. He has started and sold, you ready, four successful companies, and his most recent, Zscaler, went public in 2018. So what does it take to climb from small villager to Silicon Valley billionaire? Let's hear it from Jay Chaudhry now. Jay, welcome to Everyone Talks to Liz.
Liz, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Oh, I am honored, Jay, honestly, because you are such an inspiration to me personally. You know, we have to dive right in, though, into the news that Bitcoin, thankfully, at least in this case, isn't so anonymous. The feds tracked down and seized, what, about 63 Bitcoin, 2.3 million. You know, the price always fluctuates, but $2.3 million of the $5 million Colonial paid DarkSide, the hacker group, to unlock the pipeline operations. You've got to tell me, what message does this send to the bad actors out there thinking of installing ransomware?
I think the message it sends is the U.S. government is getting serious about it. If you think about ransomware, it has been happening for quite a while. But these folks are getting bolder and bolder. I think the mistake they made was they went after Colonial Pipeline, which means it impacts Americans, it impacts the gas price, so the country can get angry. So they probably were watching and saying, maybe we should not have gone after such a high profile attack. And ransomware payments are happening more and more with Bitcoins the world, which are harder to track. I think government stepping up, doing more things to really go after these guys is a good thing. We need to do that.
They haven't announced any arrests, but they must know. I mean, if they were able to seize back this money, this is a good step, is it not? But I'm just not sure it stops these people. We've seen this flurry of activity when it comes to ransoms. And some people are saying, you know what, we have to pay it. I mean, 16 Minutes just did a focus on a small town that, you know, all they had was 8,000. The ransom, you know, holders were asking for 60,000. I mean, this is crazy. What do you make of what appears to be increase in this activity?
You know, it's simple. I would say it's simple, but it is, unfortunately, economics. If bad people think that they can get easy money, they'll go after it. If it becomes hard, it won't be that easy to go after it, then they'll go away. The defenses around internet security have lagged far behind, and the bad guys have moved at a much faster pace. What we're seeing is the result of our defenses not being good enough. So it's not really, you can't kill or stop the bad guys unless you fix the source. You know, if I may give an example, people talk about drugs in a given country, say in the US, we could try to stop all the drugs coming from outside countries. But if we don't do something about the consumption, the need, the demand, it keeps on coming.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, our defenses and our internet security in enterprises or corporations is far behind than it should be. So it's an easy thing for these bad guys to come and ask for money.
We knew that the grid was going to be a target, but meat processing plants, to me, that was highly disturbing, because you start to look and see they know what makes people desperate. And that would be energy, obviously, what was at the heart of the Colonial Pipeline. I mean, what do you worry is next in this sort of mountain they appear to be climbing?
Yeah, I think electrical grids and many other things. So I think the key for us as a country is to step up and say, how do we increase security of our country? I was actually happy to see that the Biden administration took some steps after a Colonial Pipeline attack
mm-hmm.
to really ask our government to step up. They sent a directive, the EO, that's asking for security to be stepped up by taking certain steps. I think those are the type of things that need to be done to stop these things. We can't just keep on chasing every hacker and trying to arrest them or catch them. The defenses need to be beefed up.
We'll get to your business in a minute, which of course is all about security in the cloud. And everybody's operating in the cloud, right? I mean, these servers in the sky, because it's so unbelievably convenient, but with convenience comes danger.
Yes.
But I want to rewind the Super 8 movie camera back to your early life. Talk about what it was like growing up in the Himalayas on a farm. I mean, this to me, here you are in Silicon Valley, one of the biggest names out there, with obviously a very under the radar profile. But tell me about what started Jay Chaudhry on this path.
Yeah, before I get into it, I can tell you, I think of US as such an amazing country. It's only in America that someone having born in a tiny farmhouse can actually do all these things. No other country offers anything like this. So looking back, right, my dad was a small-scale farmer. My mom helped him. Neither of them could go to school because the school was too far away. So they wanted to make sure that I get good education. So I went to my little village school. It's hard to imagine. I mean, we had an elementary school, 5 classes with 2 rooms, and 3 classes sat under the trees. We got electricity after I finished my 8th grade. We got running water after I finished my 10th grade. But my parents actually encouraged me to work hard, to study hard. I saw them working hard. So somehow I developed a lot of fascination and interest for learning, and I studied everything I could. So I became a very good student. And I got into IITs. Those are some of the best schools in India for engineering. And from there, like many Indians, they wanted to come to the U.S. for getting master's degree, because U.S. had the best engineering degree programs for master's. And that took to the next thing.
Well, talk about that. I mean, it must have been slightly nerve-wracking to leave, you know, your continent and come to the United States. What gave you the courage to do that?
You know, I had a bigger shock to go from my tiny village to my IIT in India, in a big city, then actually coming from there to the US. The gap between my village and IIT was much bigger. Once I got to the IIT, there's so many students who knew about US. We knew many friends have gone there. We knew the best education can be had there. So also, I've been fairly, risk taker from early on. I did not realize that I could take risks for business, because there's no entrepreneurship background in my family. They were simply farmers. But I always tried adventure and new things. So coming to America for higher education was kind of learning an adventure. So was I nervous about it? Not really. I was looking forward to a new world. And I read so much about America. I loved the country. In my early days, first time I watched America landing on the moon in 69. So all those things fascinated me.
Sure. Tell me about the moment you land on terra firma in the United States. So you went to University of Cincinnati. You have to give me the sense of one of the fascinating things that you saw that you hadn't really dealt with before here in the States.
You know, I'll give you a couple of things. One, people were so friendly. When I landed on Saturday, I didn't realize that American universities are closed on Saturday. I walked on campus looking for office of foreign students. Everything was closed. I looked around. I found a professor. And I asked her, and I lost my luggage because I took Greyhound bus from New York City to Cincinnati because Greyhound was a lot cheaper than taking a second flight. She took me to the dorm, got me a room there. Then she took me back to the Greyhound bus station 4 hours later where my luggage arrived on a subsequent bus. So my first experience in America was hospitality. It was wonderful. And second, you know, the facilities, I mean, as compared to India, the dorm, the school, the campus, everything was wonderful. The libraries, I loved. So it was all great, and it was wonderful for learning. Teachers, pretty informal. You could approach them, talk to them. So I enjoyed every bit of my student life.
And you made friends, I would imagine, but you really were able to just dive into starting companies. Let's talk about your first official startup called Secure IT. You and your wife quit your jobs, put your life savings into starting this business. That has to be terrifying. I mean, why did you decide to take this leap?
Yeah, you know, the inspiration came from reading about the World Wide Web getting launched, internet was taking off, a company called Netscape launched a product called Mozilla Browser. They went public. And I started reading about it and said, wow, this young kid who had come from UIUC launched this company so successful. Why can't I do it? So I start to read more and more about it. The more I learned, the more I fell in love with it. And then I said, I got to do a startup as well. So new idea, didn't know anything about startup world before. As I read more, I got more comfortable about it, talked to my wife. So we put a business plan together. I was in Atlanta, I went to some VCs. They all turned it down. They said, you have no startup experience. And then either we could stop or we could put our life savings on the line and realize our dream. So we chose the second part.
Okay, this is where I need to dig down a little more deeply. Uh-huh. Most people will not take that chance. Right. And this podcast focuses on that very small percentage who do. You know, you and I have a slightly parallel experience here. I grew up in Los Angeles, and to start my career in broadcasting, the only job I could get was in Ohio. Just like you, going to University of Cincinnati, my first on-air market was in Columbus, Ohio. I had friends, no family, nothing. And people from my high school who were all in the movie business said, what are you doing? Why would you go to Ohio? But, you know, here I am, fast forward, you know, international newscaster, and look at you. I mean, that's the thing. What do you say about risk-taking when you talk to people who are at the start of their journey?
Yeah. You know, risk can be taken based on a couple of things. One, you know, if you know something, you learn, you build conviction, you have confidence. And then the risk doesn't look like risk. It looks like an opportunity. You know, risk taking needs to be looked at its own context. The way I look at it is the following. When you start learning something, you understand it, you build conviction around it, and what one person looks at risk looks like an opportunity to the other person.
Right.
Since I learned so much about security, I could see the opportunity to help enterprises. I really didn't look at it as a risk at all. But the second part, the risky part was, if we put our life savings on the line, we could lose all this money. So first of all, I had good confidence that it should work out. I don't have any attachment for money. In childhood, I never saw any money. So it's one of those things, let's try it. If we lose it, we can always find a job. that was the notion where we started. In fact, I had my wife quit her job too. She used to work at Bell Salt in Atlanta.
Okay.
The notion was, let's burn the bridges behind so there's no turning back and we only look forward and succeed.
We're not done yet. We'll be back in a moment.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Kilmeade. I want you to join me weekdays at 9 a.m. East as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and, of course, what you think.
Listen live or get the podcast now at BrianKilmeadeShow.com.
What was the moment where you said, wait, this is actually working. We're getting customers. We're making money.
In 4 to 5 months, pretty quickly. So I hired a small team and we started and going to talking to companies to show them the problems they have of internet security and how we could solve them. And there was nobody else talking about a solution and understanding like us. So we start to get pretty good sized deals pretty quickly. So yeah, within 6 months, it felt very comfortable that it will be pretty successful. We did $5 million in year one revenues with 20% pre-tax profits. $1 million in profit. So it was fascinating. It felt too good to be true. It felt like a dream.
But it wasn't too good to be true. I mean, you had worked it. You had really dived right in. And at the time, can you give me the year of this? Because I can imagine things have gotten a lot more challenging in the, you know, cybersecurity world and all of the different iterations that these bad actors morph into. They just keep changing. They're like a virus.
Yes. So Secureit or Secure IT was started in January of 97, early on. It was just taking off.
You're the king now of building successful companies. Obviously, Secure IT was one of the big ones in the beginning, but then you launched Air Defense, which was acquired by Motorola, Cipher Trust.
Yep.
Acquired by Secure Computing, then Core Harbor, acquired by Verizon. But, and then, you know, not to mention that Secure IT was acquired by VeriSign.
Mm-hmm.
There were some huge names here. Were there any company offers that you just said, no, I'm not going to sell?
Yes. Even for Secure IT, there are many offers. Even VeriSign, I turned them down twice before I took the offer. And I could do that again because I really didn't kind of run after money. I was comfortable. I was confident we are doing well. But eventually, it made sense to bring the business together. But you know, there's this interesting story behind my subsequent startups. When Secure IT happened so well, I said, was it a fluke or can I really build a business systematically? Let me do it again and prove it to myself. Mm-hmm. That is part of the reason, though. The other driver was 70 of my 80 employees at Secure IT became millionaires with the stock options. It was nice. So satisfying. I mean, the most gratifying thing for me was that. And I said, if I do more companies, more people who work with me, hopefully more of them will become financially independent. Mm-hmm. That's what led me to do the next three companies. So the story was, I was looking at there saying, huh, this time I have more money, so I can put only so much money in one company. So let me do multiple. Do it like having kids. You stagger them a year or two apart. So that's how I started three companies, 1 or 2 years apart from each other.
Okay, this brings me to Zscaler.
Right.
Why was Zscaler the company you decided to take that sort of dive in and take public? Because that is a mega step.
It is. Once my first four companies became successful, like most startups, they got acquired. I had no desire at this stage to do one more point product startup and sell it. I want to do something big. I want to do something lasting. And I was using Salesforce and NetSuite, these two SaaS companies, in all of my startups. I like them. I saw how Salesforce was such an easy product to use and deploy. So getting inspiration from Salesforce, I said, let's build a Salesforce of cloud security. Let's do something lasting. Security is broken. So many hacks are happening out there. I'm going to build security in the cloud for the new world of cloud where people are mobile. And I want to take this company public because I want to build a lasting company that has impact on the industry.
Who was your first oh wow client for Zscaler?
At Zscaler, the first very large client was Nestle in Europe with 160,000 employees. And before that, I had a number of small companies who was 5, 10, 20,000 users. But Nestle became very big for us.
I can imagine. I want to know how big the day was when you took Zscaler public. What was that moment like? I mean, we've talked to a lot of entrepreneurs and visionaries, and they all have different experiences, but most of it is exhaustion and their stomach in knots, nervousness. What was it like for you?
You know, honestly, I don't get overly nervous or worried. I work hard and then I figure out what the results will be. The results will be. We worked very hard. We had a very good team. I had about 85 of Zscaler's employees and senior leaders in New York at NASDAQ ready to celebrate the hard work all of them had put in for 10 years. It takes a while. Yeah, it took us 10 years to get public. It was great to see the stock go from $16 to close that day at $33.
Wow.
It is exciting. Lots and lots of families were very happy and very excited.
Well, it's 192 today. So $26 billion market cap. May I ask, did your parents, are they still around? Do they get to see your success? Did they get to see this moment where you were up on the big NASDAQ wall?
They did. They're very proud and happy parents, aww, though they don't fully understand what I do.
I know. Parents are sometimes like that. What is it again that you do? It's incredible. You know, when you look at the landscape today in Silicon Valley, what do you think is missing in this country? Because a lot of people say your experience, for example, is not so easily mirrored or duplicated anymore. There's such a wealth gap and an education gap that some would argue it's a lot harder to do what you did, Jay. Do you agree with that or disagree?
I don't agree with that. I think America is the best land of opportunity. If you work hard and you work smart, sky is the limit. I mean, I had no special help in America. I mean, I think the biggest thing I was doing was I was working hard and smart, and people were willing to help. My professors at University of Cincinnati, they helped me a lot. I think sometimes we get a sense of entitlement. We want more without working hard. So my message to folks out there is just there is no other country where you can get opportunity to start, fail, start over, raise money, do it. It happens here. And you just need to go and try and not give up. Sometimes people do startups to get rich quick. So if someone is doing a startup to do so, they're going to be disappointed.
Right.
Right. If you have passion for building something, you should do it because then it's not hard work. You have fun and success comes to you because you're passionate about something.
It is such an important message because the fruit is there for the American dream. You just have to climb the tree. And yeah, sometimes that isn't easy and you'll slip. Yep. Talk to me about the slips that you had. Was there a moment where you failed and you were concerned or worried? You don't strike me as the guy who says I might give up here, but do you remember any really difficult times? We try and share those with our listeners because it isn't all sunshine and rainbows on the climb up.
Yeah, yeah. No, there's so many of them. I'll give you one interesting one very early on, even before starting my company. I was an engineer by training. And in my first company, they tried to take me out to show computer systems I had written as demos to customers. That's when I discovered that I enjoy engaging with people than writing code in front of a computer. That changed me to become, to go in sales with IBM. So I joined IBM in sales and they assigned GE, General Aircraft Company, as my customer. I would call them, they'll hang up on me. I'll call them, they'll hang up.
Oh my God.
And And I was really in tears and said, did I make a mistake by moving from engineering to sales? Maybe I'm not cut out for sales, but I persisted. And eventually I succeeded and it became extremely successful. But that lesson for me was don't give up. But I did have passion for engaging and talking to people. So that was one good lesson I learned, that if you have passion for something, you don't give up, you succeed. That is, I never forget that, because that was one of the things where I was very desperate. Now, in the entrepreneurship world, at Zscaler, for example, the technology we built was very good early on. Since the technology was so disruptive, and a lot of companies said, is it really real? Should my security be done in the cloud? No, not really. So there are lots and lots of them who said no. They said, go and build these security boxes for my data center. Right? Refused to do that. But for every 10 customers who said no, one customer said, what you built is cool. I want to buy it.
See, you just need that one. And then you build upon that. So do you have another company inside you that you're just itching to build?
I think this is big. This is very good. Eventually, one day after my retirement, I want to get back into kind of giving back full time, where I have passionate for education. Without education, I would still be in that small village.
Right.
So I want to do a nonprofit startup where I want to make the best education content available to anyone in any part of the world without worrying about how much money do we have. But that's kind of farther away, but that's what my one other dream is.
Well, that's the thing, you know, the generosity to turn around and reach back and help people who really need it is something that I love to see in entrepreneurs when they have really made it and they know the struggle. It's really wonderful to see them giving back. If you could go back and see yourself as a 10-year-old Jay Chaudhary, what would you tell that young boy in the Himalayas sitting in a very tiny classroom?
I would have two lessons, two things to give. One, work hard. It's a good thing. There are no shortcuts in life. Lesson number two, it's all about learning and education. Education can change the world for anyone and everyone. And don't look for excuses that says, I can't do this because I have this limitation or I have that limit. If you just go after things, you start overcoming so-called perceived limitations and you achieve what you want to achieve.
The one thing that surprises me about you, Jay, is all these Silicon Valley guys who become members of the 3-comma club, they all want to buy a piece of a sports team, a pro team. You're not there yet? You know, I mean, there's always some hockey team out there that's struggling.
I'm not sure that'll ever happen.
Well, it's a pleasure, an honor to hear your story. And I just can't thank you enough for sharing it. I'm blown away. Thank you so much, Jay Chaudhary of Zscaler. And how prescient, right, to have him as a guest when we know all of this drama is happening in the ransomware world. Oy vey. As we say in French, darling. Thank you so much for tuning in once again to Everyone Talks to Liz. And I'll see you Monday through Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern. Final hour of trade. It's the only hour that really matters, guys. Fox Business. Thanks so much for joining me.
I'm Guy Benson. Join me weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and guests. Listen live on the Fox News app or get the free podcast at GuyBensonShow.com.